Ecclesiastes chapter 3, starting in verse 14. The Word of God reads, I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing taken from it. God does it that men should fear before Him. That which has already been and what is to be has already been, and God requires an account of what is past. Moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. I said in my heart, concerning the condition of the sons of men, God tests them, that they may see that they themselves are like animals. For what happens to the sons of men also happens to animals. One thing befalls them, as one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all are from the dust, and all return to dust. Who knows the spirit of the sons of men, which goes upward, and the spirit of the animal, which goes down to the earth? So I perceive that nothing is better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. For who can bring him to what will happen after him? Chapter 4, verse 1. Then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. And look, the tears of the oppressed, but they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors there is power, but they have no comforter. Therefore I praise the dead who were already dead, more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun.
Let's pray. Lord God, we come before you now with all the various things that we have dragged in here with us, some of the hardships and heartaches and difficulties. And Lord, I see these words at the beginning of chapter 4. You say, look at the tears of the oppressed. They have no comforter. Power is on the side of their oppressors. Lord, there are some here that are like that. There are tears being shed or tears being bottled up because of mistreatment or insensitivity or whatever. And there's no comfort. There's nobody there who can help the situation. The person who's hurting them is going to keep doing it, and nothing can be done about that. And Lord, this is a great hardship in life. And in this passage, you call us, you teach us how to deal with that. Lord, it's so frequent that it happens. I pray that this message would really sink in. It would come across. I was afraid last night, Lord, that it wasn't being clear, that I wasn't communicating, and I need your help, Lord. I pray that your Spirit would come upon me in power at this moment and enable me to show your people some of the things that you've showed me this week in this passage, that we might be able to live lives of joy in the midst of a hard world. We pray this in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. Amen. So we're in the midst of a study, verse-by-verse study, through the book of Ecclesiastes. We had to leave off last time in the middle of a section. We stopped halfway through chapter 3. So if you're just now joining us in this study, I'll tell you the biggest thing we've seen so far in as far as the message of the book of Ecclesiastes is this. How do you deal with life in a cursed, fallen, feudal world? Two things. Fear God, enjoy life. Okay? Fear God and just enjoy the ride. Those are the two themes that just run through the book. And then you ask the question, well, how do you do that? How do you enjoy God in a cursed, futile, hard world? By trusting Him with the things that are outside of your control. So trust is a huge part of it. You've got to trust God. You've got to trust that what He's doing is beautiful in its time. And that's the point that he makes so powerfully at the beginning of chapter 3. He makes everything beautiful in its time. Everything, everything. He schedules every event that ever takes place on his calendar. Every life and death, peace and war, love and hatred, all of it gets scheduled by him. And his timing in bringing about those various seasons in your life is perfect. It's impeccable. It's beautiful. Now, most of the time, we can't see that beauty. We won't see it. We'll never see it until we get to heaven. But that's actually a good thing that we can't see what's beautiful about these things, because the less you can see it, the more it requires faith. And the more we exercise faith, the more we honor God and benefit ourselves. It glorifies him and it benefits us, because the more we trust in him, the more ability he grants us to enjoy life, even when life is hard. Seeking that kind of enjoyment then, seeking to enjoy life that way, enjoyment from God, that's a good thing to do. It's always a good thing to do. It's not selfish. It's okay. It's more than okay. Glorifies God. It'll never lead you into sin, seeking that kind of enjoyment, because getting the gift of enjoyment from God requires living a life that pleases him. So obviously it's never going to lead you into sin. It's Ecclesiastes 2:26. To the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom and knowledge and happiness. So this is an enjoyment of life that is based on the fear of God, and so it's always the kind of enjoyment that's going to bring glory and honor to him and joy and delight to us. That's what we've seen so far. That's the kind of a summary up to now. Now, all of that is not hard to understand in theory, right? I mean, you can understand all that stuff that I just said in theory, but it's a very hard concept for us to believe enough to where we actually live this way. So Solomon is going to just keep hitting it. He doesn't end the book right here. He's going to keep hitting it from angle after angle, different perspectives, showing us this from all sides, God's control, God's sovereignty. He wants us to see it from all directions so that no matter what situation you face in life, you'll be able to apply this principle. You'll be able to know how it fits. Believing God is in control of everything is just so absolutely critical in so many ways. And so he just keeps hitting it. He gets it again here in verse 14. I know that all God does will last forever. There is no adding to it, no taking away from it. God works so that people will fear him. Whatever is, has already been. And whatever will be, already is. God repeats what is past. Now that last phrase, God repeats what is past, literally, it's God seeks what has been chased away. I think what that's saying there is, we chase something away. We drive something away. We work to put an end to this thing. We get rid of it, do away with it. Sooner or later, here it comes back again. We have the power. The point there is we have the power to make small changes in our little realm, but we're absolutely powerless to fundamentally change the overall big picture. Therefore, fear God. Fear the one who can change the big picture. Whatever you observe happening in your life, your response should be to take seriously the God who controls it all. That's what fearing God means. Take him seriously. So there's what we've learned, but there's a giant problem with all of this. This whole enjoy life because everything comes from God and he makes all things beautiful in their time, that whole philosophy, there's a giant problem with that. What about sin? What about sin? I mean, if God causes everything, if he schedules every event on his calendar, if he brings all this about, what are we going to say about sin? Is he responsible for sin? Is he guilty? I mean, how does God want us to think about him in his sovereignty in relationship to sin? It's a major problem. But the author of Ecclesiastes isn't one bit afraid of it. He's not going to shy away. He's going to hit it head on. And he does so by singling out one particular sin that to him, it seems like this is the sin of all the sins. This is the one that bugs him the most. He's going to bring it up again and again in the book. This sin is such a horrible reality, and yet it's so prevalent, it's so common, that it really poses the biggest threat to Solomon's whole message, this whole trust God and enjoy the ride message. And it's the problem, this sin, it's the problem of oppression and injustice. Look at verse 16. I also observed under the sun, there is wickedness at the place of judgment, and there's wickedness at the place of righteousness. Now, the place of judgment, place of righteousness, no doubt that refers to the law courts, the legal system, the place where justice is supposed to prevail. That's the reason for human government. The reason human government exists is for justice. That's why we have them. To punish the guilty and protect the innocent, that's what the law courts are supposed to do. And Solomon takes a look at the human justice system and the law courts, and he's just appalled at how much corruption there is and how often injustice is perpetrated on people in those very places. And it's a horrible thing. And so he brings it up again and again. In fact, we don't have to wait very long for him to bring it up a second time. It's right there in chapter 4, verse 1. He says, "Again, I observed all the acts of oppression being done under the sun. Look at the tears of those who are oppressed. They have no one to comfort them. Power is with those who oppress them. They have no one to comfort them." You know, when you do that, when you look at the tears, you know, it's one thing to just hear about on the news. You know, you hear about a human rights violation in some country on the news or in a textbook or something. But if you do what Solomon says to do here and you actually take time to look at their tears, I mean, you think about what life is like for them, how it feels to be in their shoes, you do that for very long, it's overwhelming. It's hard to do. Many of us have done that with Pastor Saeed's situation, right? We've followed him and thought about him in the prison in Iran, and it's almost, you can't even think about it very long. It'll get you down. It's hard to think about. Well, Pastor Saeed, that's one man. He's just one of millions of people in the world who are being treated in horrific ways. In Somalia, they take their little girls, many places in Africa, 95% of little girls ages 4 to 11 undergo the savage and barbaric process of female genital mutilation. Just a horrific thing. Children in Uganda kidnapped and forced to murder their parents, and if they take too long to do it, they're beaten with 50 strokes with a cane. And if they show nervousness, they're shot. The unspeakable atrocities of human trafficking and the sex trade and the unbelievable beatings those girls undergo right after they're kidnapped. There are horrors that go on in this world that are too painful for us to even think about. And those people who are undergoing it, they have no one to turn to. There's no one there. There's no one to help them. They can't call the police. They can't. The power is in the hands of those who are hurting them. And the justice system is completely failing them. How do we explain that? If God is in control, He schedules everything on His calendar, and He's in total sovereign control over everything, what are we to make of this, of the horrors of injustice? Now, we know for sure that God's in total control of all things, and we know for sure that God is not guilty of evil in any way. But how do we put that together? I think putting that together is something that's a mystery. I think that's beyond the capability of the human mind to understand how it all fits together. We just need to believe both truths. But if you want to know the right direction to go in your thinking when you run into that difficulty in your thinking, like these two hard truths to reconcile, where should we turn in our thinking? Here it is, verse 17. This is the way to think about it. Because there's theologically, there's a lot of directions you can go with this. And here's a really good one, verse 17. I said to myself, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, since there is time for every activity and every work. So how do we square the whole God makes everything beautiful in His time principle with the problem of injustice and sin and wickedness and evil? You do it by focusing on the fact that God will judge every act of wickedness and punish all unrighteousness and reward all righteousness. He'll make everything right someday. He's going to come back. He's going to make everything right. He's going to repay you for everything that was taken from you and it was lost in unjust ways. He's going to vindicate your name when you were in the right. He's going to make it all right. He's going to punish wickedness and make everything right. That's where our mind should go whenever we think about injustice. Whenever we get worked up about injustice, God's going to make it right. It's only temporary. It's a very temporary situation. He's going to come. He's going to make it right. Okay? Therefore what? Therefore, fear God. That's his conclusion. Whether you're the one being oppressed or you're the one doing the oppression, either way, fear God. Same conclusion. If you're mistreating people and you're taking advantage of people and you're hurting people, look out. Be afraid of judgment day because it's not going to go well for you on that day. And if you're being mistreated and you're being abused and hurt, you need to realize human beings aren't the solution to your problem, right? Human beings aren't going to be much help. The only one who can actually help you is God. And so he should matter to you more than anything else, which is the definition of fearing God. Whether you are rescued or left at the mercy of people who are going to hurt you depends totally on what God decides. And so you definitely don't want to be at odds with him, right? He should matter to you. You want to take him seriously and make it your goal to please him and avoid dishonoring him at all costs. He's your only hope, so live in fear of him. So whether you're the oppressor or the oppressed, either way, fear God. So when it comes to enjoying life by fearing God, the existence of evil seems to be a problem for that. And so the preacher shows us right away how to think about the problem of the existence of evil. Focus on God's ultimate justice and put all your hope in that. Put your hope in Judgment Day. So that problem, that solves that problem. But now there's another problem, another difficulty, another reality that would seem to throw a wrench in his whole system here, this philosophy of enjoying life by fearing God. And that is the problem of death. I mean, death, the existence of death, and not just dying, but the whole process of death, everything that comes along with death, the sickness and disease and decay and corruption of our bodies, the corruptibility of our bodies, everything going downhill, all of that hardship. How do you enjoy life when that's a reality? How do you enjoy life when your body keeps falling apart? And you know you're going to die. Well, Solomon's not afraid of this problem either. He's going to hit this one right between the eyes. I mean, he already brought up the topic of death a few times in this book, and now in verse 18, man, he's going to hit it with some brutal honesty. It almost sounds like he goes too far. He says, I said to myself concerning people, God tests them that they may see that they are like animals, for the fate of people and the fate of animals is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. And they all have the same breath. People have no advantage over animals since everything is futile. Wow. So he's saying, look, we're mortal. And not only are we mortal, we're just as mortal as the animals. Now, does that mean we're animals? Is he saying we're just animals? No. No, if we were just another species of animal, then this wouldn't make any sense. It wouldn't make any sense to compare us to animals, right? If we were animals, it wouldn't make any sense to say we're like them, because we would be them. Human beings are not animals. We're not just evolved animals. We're different. We bear the image of God. But there are some similarities. We're like the animals. You say, how? In what way are we like the animals? Well, let's look at the text. And I think the Holman is just a little bit misleading here, because the Holman inserts these words, this happens, in verse 18. To make it sound like he's referring backward to all the oppression. So the Holman takes the view that he's saying, look, God lets all this oppression stuff happen so that we all understand we're just a bunch of animals, you know, we're behaving like animals. I don't think that's the point. Because if you look at what he says after that, he says we're like animals, then he gives an explanation. He tells us exactly what he has in mind. People are similar to animals, not in every way, but in the sense that animals and people have the same breath. You see that in verse 19? They have the same breath. Now, what does that mean? The word breath is the Hebrew word ruach, common Hebrew word. It can be translated breath or wind or spirit. Now, here it's translated breath, I think rightly, because it's talking about our life breath. Your life breath is that which animates your body. It's the way, the Hebrew way of thinking about the thing that makes you alive. The difference between your body 1 minute before death compared to 1 minute after death. Okay? What's missing? You know, 1 minute after you die, all the components of life are there. Everything scientists say is needed for life is there in all the right proportions. It's all there. All the chemicals are there. All the DNA is there. Your cells are all there. Your organs are all there. Everything's there. And yet, you're dead. What's the difference? What's missing? Well, the thing that's missing is what Scripture refers to as your life breath. Okay? That's the difference between a dead body and a living body. Life breath. And the point here is that we have the same life breath as the animals. It's the same. Which means we're just as vulnerable to becoming dead as they are. When it comes to the biggest problem we face in life, physically, our mortality, we have zero advantage over the animals. We're the same. We're in the same boat as them. If an animal takes a bullet to the head, it dies. If a human being takes a bullet to the head, you die. Right? Even though you're in the image of God, you're dead. If you see a rat running around the floor, you can look at that thing and think, well, it's just a matter of time before the lifespan of that little thing runs out and its life is over and that little body will stop moving and start rotting. That's how it is with rats. That's how it is with kings. That's how it is with movie stars. That's how it is with you and me. Verse 20, we're all going to the same place. All come from dust and all return to dust. And then this difficult verse, verse 21. Who knows if the spirit of people rises upward and the spirit of animals goes downward to the earth? Now, the way they've translated that, I think, is a bit misleading. When it says the spirit of people and the spirit of animals, that word spirit, it's the same word. It's ruach. It's that same word that just translated breath in verse 19. And I can't see any good reason to assume a change of meaning and translate it a different way here in verse 21. I think it's the same meaning. He's still talking. It's the same context. He's still talking about our life breath. See, verse 21, it tends to be troubling to people at first glance because we've got a concept in our mind of what happens at death that didn't exist in the Old Testament times. We've got a concept that somebody dies and your spirit either goes up to heaven or down to hell. Right? That's the way we think. You go up or you go down. They didn't think that way in Old Testament times. In the Old Testament, death is always pictured as going down. Always. Even for the believer. We all go down to the grave, right? We all go 6 feet under. That's the idea. Now, in the case of a believer, from there, afterward, you go to be with the Lord, right? Your soul goes to live forever in paradise with the Lord. But that's the afterlife. And he's not talking about the afterlife here. He's talking about life under the sun. This life. This life. And what he's saying is, who knows if your breath is going to go upward or down into the grave. And I think what that means is, I'm convinced what this is talking about is living as opposed to dying. If your breath goes up, that means you're still on your feet. You're still walking around. You're still alive. You're still kicking. But if your breath goes down to the grave, that means you're dead. I think that's what it means. And I'll give you an example of another place that speaks that way. Proverbs 15:24. It says, the path of life leads upward for the wise to keep him from going down to the grave. See that? So instead of going down to the grave, he goes upward. So the opposite of the grave is this upward trajectory, which is being alive, remaining alive. So the point isn't that he's saying, well, who knows if animals and human beings go two different places when they die. That's not what he's saying. That would be a flat-out contradiction of what he just said in the previous verse, in verse 20. He says, all are going to the same place. He just said that. All come from dust, all return to dust. There's no question where we go when we die. All of us, animals, people, we all go down to it. In this life under the sun, we go down into the grave. 6 feet under. That's established. That's not what he's saying. That's unknown. That's known. What's unknown, what you don't know, is whether you're going to go first or your dog. Right? That's what you don't know. That's what he's saying here. You don't know if an animal's going to die first or you're going to die first. If a man rides a horse into a battle, he doesn't have any way of knowing if he's going to make it back and the horse is going to end up dead on the battlefield or if it's going to be the other way around. Could go either way, right? In fact, horses are actually a little tougher than human beings. And even if you do live longer, even if you do outlive your pets, honestly, it's not by very much. In the whole scope, the relative scope of the human timeline of history, you don't outlive your dog by very much. You're going to die. Just like an animal, you're going to die. Now, you might be thinking at this point, Daryl, this sermon isn't really helping me enjoy life at this point. I mean, it's not getting me there. It's not making me happy. Is this morbid? This is a morbid thing to say for me to stand up and say, you're all going to die like animals. Is it a morbid, joy-killing thing to think about the fact of death and mortality? Is the way to be happy in life to just put that out of your mind? Stop thinking about death. Get it out. Just forget it. Pretend it doesn't exist. That's what most people do. That's the approach that most people in the world, you know, they're afraid of death, and so they just put it out of their mind. They just pretend it's never going to happen. It's never going to happen to them. It's never going to happen to anyone they love. And when it does happen to someone we love, we're shocked and stunned. How could this happen? A human being died. Like, what a shock. That happens to every human being. It's the most certain reality there is in this life. You're going to die. Everybody's going to die. I checked. I looked up the death rate in the United States. Despite all the medical advancements, the death rate still hasn't changed. One each. Right? It's one to one. It's absolutely certain. And yet, if you bring up the topic in conversation, people are horrified. You know, like, I was just at the dentist on Thursday. And I was sitting in the chair, and I was behind on my sermon preparation, so I was trying to get some stuff done. So I had my laptop on my lap while they're doing the thing. And I figured every time she left the room, I'd just get a little bit of work done. So she left the room. I'm working on my laptop. And she comes in. She walks in. And on my sermon notes, I have the headings in giant red bold print. The heading for, I happened to be working on this section. And so the heading at that time in my notes, it said, "You're going to die!" Exclamation point. So she walks back into the room, and she immediately sees my laptop, and right across the top of the screen in giant letters, "You're going to die!" Exclamation point. And she's like, "Oh, well, that's kind of..." And she didn't know what to say. She's lost for words. And so I explained to her, I'm a pastor, I'm working on a sermon on Ecclesiastes, and she didn't know what that meant, but she's like, "Well, I hope we don't die." And I kind of chuckled, and I said, "Well, we're all going to die." And she said, "Well, yeah, but hopefully not right now." And I was happy to agree with her on that point. But the idea that we're all going to die, it's just so certain. It's the most certain reality in the world. And yet it's just shocking and offensive thought for most people. Because the way they try to deal with it, the way they try to live a happy life, is just by getting it out of their mind. So if you need to be happy in order to forget about death, why does Solomon bring it up? He doesn't just bring it up. It's like he's rubbing it in our face. You know? His objective in this book is to get us to enjoy life. So why this section? Is he going to solve the problem by pointing to the resurrection? Just say, "Yeah, you're going to die. But then you'll be raised with Christ forever and receive a new body and everything." Well, no, he's not going to do that. Now, that is our great hope, for sure. That is our great hope. And that's what we look to. But that Solomon is not talking about the afterlife. He's talking about this life. Life under the sun. Life in a cursed, fallen, hard, futile world. How do you enjoy life under the sun when you've got to deal with death, the fact of being as mortal as an animal? How do you do it? Look what he says. Look at verse 22. "I have seen that there's nothing better for a person to enjoy his activity to enjoy his activities, because that is his reward, his lot in life. For who can enable him to see what will happen after he dies?" See, remembering the reality of death doesn't hinder joy. Forgetting about death hinders joy. In order to enjoy life, you've got to remember death. That's why he's bringing it up. He's bringing it up because we need it to really enjoy life. Because if we don't remember death, here's what'll happen. What'll happen is we'll waste our whole life saying, "I'll be happy when." We'll start getting into this, "I'll be happy when, you know, whatever. I'll be happy when I get this income, when I get this promotion, when I get this career, when I get married, when I get kids, when I finish school, when I do this, when I do that." And our hope is always in the next thing, next thing, next thing. I'll be happy when that next stage, that next time, that next season of life hits. Right now, I don't really have time to serve God, enjoy His gifts. I'm scrambling right now to get this goal. I got to reach these goals. I got to get this stuff, and then I'll be happy. I'll settle down, get serious about seeking God, heart after God, and communion with God. Then, once I get these goals, but you reach the goals, they don't satisfy. Then it's the next goal, the next goal. Pretty soon, all your hope is in retirement, and you're trying to gather up way more money than you need just to make sure you don't cut it close in your retirement years. And then you will start wanting to make a difference and a legacy, leave a legacy that will last after you're gone, and none of that is wrong within the bounds of wisdom and pleasing God. But when it becomes your hope, then you're going to find that you're going to get all the way to the end of your life and you forgot to live. You're going to waste your life. You're going to try to make yourself bigger than you are and take up more space on the timeline of human history than the lifespan that God gave you. And that becomes an exercise in futility. You're trying to do something that can't be done. And what will happen is you're going to work way too many hours. You're going to neglect your relationships. You're going to become proud. You're going to mistreat people. And all for what? Nothing. No benefit. You've reached all these goals, but for what? So once you're in the grave, someone's just going to come along after you and undo everything you did. Where does it get you? And so I think Solomon's point here is simply this. Look, you're going to die. So in the meantime, live. Right? That's what he's saying. He's saying, we're all going to die like animals. But in the meantime, we've got some time to kill. Let's live. Let's live. Live life to the fullest. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your strength. Enjoy life through the fear of God. Enjoy the things that are enjoyable in life. See, when Solomon brings up death, it's not to make you depressed. His purpose is joy. He wants you to enjoy life, but he knows that if you take the typical head-in-the-sand approach to death and just refuse to think about it, you're going to ruin your life. This little bit of time you do have in this world is going to be ruined. Because you're going to live like there's always a tomorrow. And that's not the path to joy, because it makes you blind to what can be enjoyed today. So enjoy life. Realize how short it is. Enjoy what you got. Now, does this mean that you just go through life giggling 24/7? You know, you just get this giddy attitude? Several times in this study, people have asked that. We keep getting the question, wait a minute, isn't there a place for sorrow? Isn't there a place for tears? He's telling us, just trust God and enjoy the ride. Is he living in a fantasy world? Is he oblivious? Is he naive to reality? No, he's not, obviously. I mean, you read this book. No one is more honest about the harsh reality of sin and sorrow and futility than the writer of the Ecclesiastes. Look again, chapter 4, verse 1. He's right back to the problem of oppression. Look at the tears. He's not in any fantasy land. He's looking at people's tears. Look at the tears of those who are oppressed. They have no one to comfort them. Verse 2, so I admired the dead who have already died more than the living who are still alive. But better than either of them is the one who has not yet existed, who has not seen the evil activity that is done under the sun. So he's right back to that. He comes back to that. He has to come back to that. Because telling us to enjoy life through fearing God, because God makes everything beautiful in its time, is meaningless if you don't deal with the elephant in the room, the problem of suffering and evil. You got to deal with that. There are things that people go through in life that are just, not just a little bit hard, they're so incredibly painful that the person wishes he was dead, literally wishes he was dead, or even wishes he was never even born to begin with, so he wouldn't have ever had to even face it. And that happens to millions of people all day, every day, all over the world. So when Solomon tells us enjoy life, he's not naive about hardships. He's not telling us to just paint on a smile when it's appropriate to weep. That's not what he's saying. Remember, this is wisdom literature, okay? Remember about wisdom literature. It's proverbial. Remember, proverbs are not absolute rules. They're general principles that apply generally, not absolute rules. So he says, enjoy life. Of course there's times to weep. Of course there's times to weep. But generally speaking, life is jammed full of moments that are possible to enjoy. They can be enjoyed. That's a gift from God. And the man or woman that ignores that is a fool. The fool. God didn't provide those moments that can be enjoyed so that we would ignore them. He provided them so we would enjoy them. And if you do ignore them, that's the life of a fool. And I realize still this, even with that explanation, to some of you this sounds just like a contradiction, flat out contradiction. How can I enjoy life as coming from the hand of a good God, a good, wise, caring, loving God, and at the same time acknowledge the wickedness of men sinning against me as real wickedness and evil and the horror that it is? Because, you know, if it's appropriate for me to be distressed over evil things that are done to me, if that's appropriate, and I have lots and lots of evil things that are being done to me right now, then how can I enjoy life in general? One answer to that question is to remind ourselves about Judgment Day. Okay, we already saw that answer. God will make it all right, and we put our hope in that. That's a key thing. But that's not the only part of the solution. There's more to it. Thinking about God making all things right on Judgment Day should be a hope that carries us through hardship, for sure. But it's also crucial that we remember this other fact, that God has made all things here and now beautiful in their time, which points to His goodness and His sovereign control. And it's essential that we come back, keep coming back to that perspective, the sovereignty of God, the control of God over all things, even over sins that people commit against you. He's even in control of that. In fact, especially there. It's especially crucial to think about the sovereignty of God when people sin against you and hurt you. Because when you get hurt, when horrible things happen to you, two things are taking place. On the one hand, evil people are doing evil things. And on the other hand, God is doing beautiful things in the same action. Please get that. It's not just that God comes along after the fact and makes it eventually work out for good. He plans it. He orchestrates it before the foundation of the world, before those people hurting you ever existed. He put this on the calendar. I want you to see this. So turn to Genesis chapter 50. Go ahead and turn your Bible to Genesis 50. Last chapter of Genesis. We read in Genesis about a young man who seemed to have a very promising life. Starting out, God was blessing this guy more than all the people around him, and he just really had a lot going for himself, seemed like. But then something terrible happened, probably in his teens, probably a teenager. And his family became so envious of him because of all God's blessing that they began to hate him. And must have been a very lonely situation for him. They rejected him. They treated him horribly. Nothing he could do about it. They ended up selling him into slavery. Now imagine, just take a second here and think. Imagine yourself in his shoes. Just picture what this feels like. You're sold to human traffickers. Not kidnapped, sold by your family on purpose to human traffickers. And you're taken away to some foreign country where you don't speak the language. You're a teenager. You don't speak the language. You don't know anybody. And you become a slave. And then from there, things get worse, much worse. You are still trying to honor God. You're obeying God. You love the Lord. You say, okay, I'm a slave. I'll be the best slave I can for the glory of God. And that's your attitude. It's a great attitude. And so you try to be the best slave you can. And where does that get you? It gets you unjustly accused and thrown into prison. Just like Pastor Saeed. And now you're in this horrible dungeon and there's no legal counsel. There's no embassy. There's no one sending out a Facebook campaign to get you freed. There's nothing. You're just there. And best you can tell, you're going to be there the rest of your life. This is it. And you sit there, and year after slow, agonizing year creeps by, and you're just wasting away in this horrible dungeon, all because you obeyed God, and wicked people didn't like it. This was Joseph. This was the life of Joseph. And Joseph's brothers did all that to him. But then years later, when he was in a position of power and they came to ask him for help, look what he said. Genesis 50:20. Look at verse 20. He said to them, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." God, now what does it mean? God meant it for good. Well, if you read, what's the good that God meant it for? I got two questions here. Meant what for good and what good? Okay, let's start with the second one. What good did God mean it for? Well, if you've read the book of Genesis, you know the answer to that. God gives Joseph the ability to interpret dreams and eventually brings him to Pharaoh. He interprets Pharaoh's dream about the coming famine. Pharaoh's impressed, puts him in second in command in Egypt, gives him all this power so he can store up, stockpile food to carry the people through the famine. And God did all that. Why? What was the good he was achieving? Well, he was rescuing, not only was he rescuing Egypt, that was only secondary. The main thing, he's rescuing the people of God, the forefathers of Israel, who all would have died out in the famine if it hadn't been for this. Many, many years ahead of time, before the famine came, God put this elaborate plan into action to bring Joseph down to Egypt, then into the prison, then up to Pharaoh in order to save the Jewish people, which would someday bring the Messiah into the world and bring salvation to all of mankind. Okay, that's the good that he was doing. That's a good thing that God was doing. That's when it says he meant it for good, that's the good. Let me ask this other question. Meant what for good? What did God intend for good? What is it exactly that he meant? Well, look at verse 15. It says, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, what if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him? Okay, that's the topic at hand. All the wrongs we did to him. The mistreatment, the jealousy, throwing him in the pit, selling him into slavery, all that. Tempting to kill him. They're scared to death. Joseph's going to be mad about all that. Well, that's understandable. I mean, that's a pretty fair bet that your brother's going to be mad about all that. Now skip down to verse 19. So they're scared to death. Oh, no, he's going to kill us. He's going to be mad. Verse 19. But Joseph said to them, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? I'm not going to hurt you. I'm not God. And then he says this. He gives them an explanation. You intended it for evil, but God intended it for good to accomplish what's now being done, the saving of many lives. So what was it that God intended for good? The wrongs done against Joseph were intended by God for good. All those sins were intended by God for good. Mocking him, mistreating him, throwing him in the well, trying to kill him, selling him into slavery. All those horrible, wicked sins that ruined Joseph's life, God intended. Now, what does intended mean? It means God did it on purpose. For a reason. God appoints and determines every season in your life, including mistreatment. It's not that the brothers just did it and God came up afterward and tried to mop up the mess and make the best of a bad situation by putting a positive spin on it. That's not what Romans 8:28 means when it says he works all things together for good for us. It's not like he's just hands off, he lets things happen and then he fixes it up. He intends those things. He plans those things. He causes them to happen to you. He said, but how could God cause them if they're sin? Well, doesn't that make him guilty of sin? No. Doesn't make him guilty of sin, and here's why. It's because God is the author of the action, but not the author of the evil in the action. Okay? That evil is supplied by a human being or by the devil, not God. But God is the author of the action itself. Did you know that it's possible in the exact same action for two people to be acting and one of them to be doing evil and the other one to be doing good at the same time? I want to try to illustrate. This is such a hard principle for people to get. And whenever I try and explain it, I always feel like I'm never quite doing it. So let me try a different illustration than I've used in the past. I've tried to illustrate this a bunch of ways, and this one's a little bit labored, so bear with me. Imagine you get infected with a rare virus that it's going to eat your internal organs and it's going to be horrible. You're going to die of agonizing death in a matter of hours once it hits. But you don't even know you have the virus yet. You're just, the only symptoms, they haven't begun yet. The only thing you got now is just a little stomach ache. Pretty soon it starts to get a little worse. You call the doctor. He sends you to the hospital. They run some tests. And there's two doctors at the hospital working on you. Two doctors. One of them's a believer and wants to help. The other one hates you and wants you to die. Secretly wants to kill you. So his plan, this bad doctor, his plan is to fill a syringe with poison and inject you with it. and make you die. Meanwhile, the good doctor figures out this, that you have this disease, and he finds the only medicine that will cure you. And this medicine, it's a compound that normally for a person would act as poison. Normally this would be poison, but in this particular case, because you have this disease, this chemical will actually save your life. And so what this good doctor does, he gets that chemical and he gives it to the bad doctor, knowing full well what's the bad doctor thinks it's poison and wants to kill you. And so the bad doctor takes this medicine, thinking it's poison, puts it in a syringe and injects you with it. And then, much to the chagrin of the bad doctor, it ends up curing you, just like the good doctor planned. So you got two doctors, and both of them did the same thing. They're both responsible for you being injected with this chemical. You say, who's responsible for you getting this chemical in your body that saved your life? Both doctors are responsible, right? They both did it. They both did the same action. But when all the facts come out in the investigation, the bad one goes to jail, the good one's rewarded as a hero. Why? Why? They both did the same thing. The same action. Why is one punished and the other rewarded? One's punished and the other's rewarded because it's possible in the exact same action for one person to mean it for good and accomplish good while the other person is intending to harm you in the same action. When someone at church gossips about you, betrays your friendship, that person is doing evil to you. Is God involved? Yes, he's causing it. He's causing the whole thing. Why? Because he wants to hurt you? Because he wants you to suffer? No, because this poison that the person is giving you is something that the good doctor knows ultimately is what you need. It's going to benefit you. It's medicine. It's a gift. Being gossiped about, being betrayed by a friend at that point in your life, he knows it's exactly what you need. It's exactly what the doctor ordered for your spiritual growth at this point. It's the best thing that could have happened to you. And he knows that. God knows that. And so like a good doctor, he gives you exactly what's best for you. But he simply allows that medicine to be administered by an evil person with evil intent. So how can God punish that? And then this question comes up. How can God punish that person? If the person is actually curing you, then how can God punish someone for that? How can God punish Judas for causing redemption to happen? You know, how can God punish the Sanhedrin and the Romans for killing Jesus? That saved the world. It ended up being a good thing. How can he punish them? If he used them to bring it about, then how can he punish them? And the answer is, they're punished. He can and will punish them because they, acting on their own free will, intended it for evil, and so they deserve to be punished, even though what they did, God used it to bring about his good. When your husband treats you harshly, or he's insensitive, or he's unfaithful to you, he hurts you, he really hurts you somehow, who's behind that? God is. It's God. It's bitter tasting medicine. It's a bitter pill to swallow. But God knows this hardship, this pain, it's exactly what you need right now. It's best for you to undergo this. It's going to be good for your faith. It's going to be good for your perseverance. It's going to be good for a whole host of reasons. Now, you can't see it now, but eventually you'll be able to see. This is the best thing that could have happened to you. When your wife is unreasonable and gets angry at you again and makes your life a hell on earth, That's medicine from God that's going to turn out to be the best thing for you right now. When you lose your job, when your boss tells you off in front of everyone else, humiliates you, when your mom and dad are unfair, your teacher is unfair, your kids disobey you again and again, when somebody scams you out of money, they rip you off, when harsh words are spoken to you, when nobody's there for you in your time of need, you don't show up, nobody notices. Those things are all evil things that evil human beings are doing to you, intending them as evil. But every single one of them is medicine from a good doctor that is exactly what's best for you at that moment. Okay, so you got all that? Because that's not even the point. All of that is just sovereignty 101. We've covered that. You know that. We understand all that. That's just basic. What I'd like to suggest this morning, and what I think Solomon's teaching us in Ecclesiastes, is that doctrine is not enough. There are many Christians who believe all that. Everything I just said, they believe that with all their heart, and they say, yeah, God's in control. He's sovereign over every single thing, even the hard things. And yet, they're still gripped with anxiety, filled with frustration and anger and stress when people do evil things to them. They get worked up, stressed out, frustrated, angry when people do hard things to them. Why? Because you ask them, do you believe that God intends us for good? Yes. Yeah, I believe that. But they still intend it for evil, and that's the part that's bugging me. Right? How do you get around that? Yes, God intended the hardships to happen to Joseph for good, but that doesn't change the fact of the brothers meant it for evil. So why doesn't Joseph get angry with them? What you would expect would be after all those years in prison, they would come back, and Joseph said, hey, I'm fine with God. I'm not so fine with you. Right? I'm mad at you. God meant it for good, and so I'm happy with God. You meant it for evil, so I'm mad at you. Wouldn't that be the natural reaction? How does Joseph manage to not be angry at them, even when he acknowledged they meant it for evil? I mean, all those years with no apology? They're not one bit repentant except now when they need some food from him? Years in prison, and yet bitterness never sets in. Why? Verse 21, he says, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children. And then he reassured them and he spoke kindly to them. He actually cares about their emotions at this point. He's trying to counsel them, to encourage them. How can he do that? How can he not be bitter? Here's how. And please, listen very carefully to this, beloved. This is a principle you're going to need every day of your life. And understanding this principle could make the difference in your life between a miserable life of anger and bitterness and a happy life of joy and enjoyment of God's gifts. So this is crucial. The reason Joseph had love for his brothers and wasn't angry or bitter was because when he looked at these two realities, that God meant it for good and they meant it for evil, he didn't stop there. The key was the first principle, that God meant it for good, eclipsed the importance of the second principle, they meant it for evil, in Joseph's heart. That's the key. The good that God was doing meant more to Joseph than the evil that they were doing. If your spouse does something that really hurts you, if that puts you into a bad mood, what does that mean? What it means is the evil that your spouse intended means more to you than the good that God intended in that action. That's why your mood goes down. If Satan wants to tempt you to get mad, and so he makes the wind blow and causes a door to slam on your fingers, and it makes you mad, what does that mean? If I'm working on my car and Satan, you know, he somehow causes me to fumble and I drop the bolt down into the engine block and I ruin my engine, I lose my bolt and everything, whatever, and it makes me angry, what does that mean? It means the evil that Satan intended means more to me than the good that God intended. Because if I'm more enraptured with the good that God is doing, then my mood is going to go up, right? The good thing that God did for me in that trial is, if I'm angry, is small in my eyes. Yes, God intended it for good, but that's small in my eyes. And he intended it for evil. That's huge in my eyes. That means that person is more important than God. In essence, I'm saying Satan matters more than God. This person matters more than God. So if you're bitter towards your spouse, it's because in that area, your spouse matters to you more than God. You see, it's not enough to just know that there's a good doctor administering you life-saving medicine and that the evil doctor was trying to hurt you. That in itself isn't going to keep you from bitterness and anger. You have to also care more about what the good doctor is doing than you care about what the bad doctor is doing. You say, how do I do that? How do I change how much I care about different things? How do I make good things matter more to me than evil things. It's hard. I mean, I'm not gonna kid you here. It's hard. I mean, obviously it's hard because the evil that's being done against you, you can see that and you can feel it. The good that God is doing, you can't see. It's invisible. So it's very natural to care more about the thing you can see and feel. So how do you get to the point where the invisible good matters more to you, affects your emotions more than the obvious evil? What should you do if you think about the good that God is doing and it only has a tiny impact on your emotions, and you think about the evil that's being done and it has a huge impact on your emotions? What should you do? When that happens, I think what that means is that your soul isn't really persuaded of what your brain is saying. Your brain is saying, God intended it for good and that matters more, and your soul isn't buying it. And so you got to persuade your soul. And the only way to persuade your soul is to spend more time focusing your attention on the beauty of the goodness of what God is doing than you spend focusing on the evil that human beings are doing. It's a matter of your thoughts. You know, people always think they don't have control over their emotions. They don't control over how they feel. That's not really true. You don't have direct control over your emotions, but you do have control over your thoughts. And your thoughts end up determining your emotions, driving your emotions. So how did Joseph make it all those years in prison without becoming bitter? There's no doubt in my mind he did it by having more thoughts about the goodness of God than he had about the evil of his brothers. Lots of thoughts about what God is doing good for every one thought of the evil that's being done. Now, Joseph had no way of knowing what this good was going to be, right? He didn't know he was saving the Jewish nation. He's just sitting in prison. So it required faith the whole time, nothing but faith. He couldn't see the good. He just had to trust. But I think that's what Solomon is teaching us here in Ecclesiastes. He wants us to enjoy life, not by pretending evil doesn't exist or that it's not really evil, but by choosing to spend more of our mental energy focusing on God's part, on the nature of God, to the point where that will matter more to us than the evil. So do we deny that there are horrible injustices taking place all the time? No, we acknowledge that. And we think about it. Go ahead and think about it. Well, you've got to spend some time thinking about it. You've got to deal with it, right? Spend however much time is necessary to deal with it, but nothing else, nothing beyond that. Soon as you deal with it, you spend whatever time you have to spend, then your mind goes right back to thinking about God's goodness, his wisdom, his beauty, his love, everything that's good about God. Because if God really does matter more to us than people, that will be reflected in how much time we spend thinking about his goodness and the beauty of his plan compared to how much time we spend about thinking about the evil things that people are doing. Because remember, fearing God means God matters to you. And if he matters to you more than people matter, then you'll spend far more time thinking about what he's intending in this trial than what they're intending. So if you're upset, full of anxiety, because someone has treated you bad or is treating you bad, I just want to urge you this morning to adopt the 10-to-1 ratio principle we've talked about before. 10 thoughts about God's goodness for every one thought about the evil that's being done to you. You say, I don't know what good he's doing in this. Perfect. You don't have to. That's fine. That's great. All you have to do is know that God is good. Right? So 10 thoughts about his nature. I'm not talking about thinking, well, maybe this will turn out to do this. Maybe this hardship will cause this, and maybe that'll happen. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm not trying to guess what God is doing. I'm just trusting his character. I know him. I know he doesn't do bad things. That. And if you have trouble, look in the Bible and study his deeds in the past. Any bad ones? No, only good ones. And study his promises for the future and for the present. Anything bad? No, only good. Study his track record. Study his resume. Study his character. Study what he's like. Study his promises. Look at his goodness. You can't think about evil things while you're thinking about that. It'll drive those evil thoughts out of your mind. You don't have to know why a person is doing good as long as you trust the person to be good. The only time you need to see it for yourself, what's good about this, is if you don't trust the person. So 10 thoughts about God's goodness and wisdom and trustworthiness and beauty and love. For every one thought about the evil that's being done to you, that will enable you to trust and fear God. And from there, just be alert to every detail of life that can be enjoyed and receive that enjoyment from God in a way that increases your love for Him, and you will have a joyful, God-glorifying life. Let's pray. Father, thank you for giving us these truths. They're hard. They're hard to grasp because there's something in us that just almost refuses to accept there can be anything good about us being hurt. So, Lord, give us faith. Give us faith to believe this. We pray this in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. Amen. Okay. Any questions about the sermon before we dismiss? Okay. What if somebody forces you to sin? Then what? How do you respond? I think if somebody forces you to do something that's sin, then if you have a choice, you just refuse to do it. It's better to die. You have a choice: I do this or I die. Just die. It's better to be killed for righteousness' sake. God will reward you for that. That's the better choice. But what if they force the issue? You don't have the option of just dying. They force you to do something that's wrong. I mean, they at gunpoint put a gun to your head and walk you into a bank and force you to help them rob the bank or something like that. Then what? Then it's not sin. I don't believe it's sin. If somebody forces you to do something, you have no choice. Even our law courts realize that. If you do something at gunpoint that somebody made you do that's against the law, you're not even responsible for it. And I think it's the same with God. I don't think God is going to punish you for things that you were forced to do, because 1 Corinthians 10:13 says there's never a time when you have to sin. There's never a time. Every temptation, there's a way out. He provides a way out. So a person is never forced to sin. So, you know, if you mentioned the sex trade, if they have to permit horrible things to be done to their body, God's not going to punish them for that. That's not sin. That girl's not committing a sin in that case. Yeah, isn't that a poignant thing when Joseph says that? It's like, you don't have to be afraid. I'm not in the place of God. What does that say about us? When we're taking revenge and we're getting mad, we're getting even with people and everything, it's like, Joseph maybe isn't in the place of God, but I am, you know, and I'm going to make you pay. I mean, that's basically what we're saying when we hold a grudge against somebody. I'm in the place of God. I'm in charge of judgment day now. So, yeah, you're right. That's powerful. That's a very poignant thought. Lee? Okay. So what if you have good intentions, but you do something that's wrong? That's actually a whole other topic, but I think when somebody has good intentions and they do something that's forbidden, like, I don't know, suppose someone's mistreating you, and I love you, I care about you, you're a good friend, and I don't want to see you hurt, so I take that guy behind the church and just beat him to a pulp, you know? And I got good intentions. I'm trying to make your life better, but I do something that's sinful. Is that still wrong? And the answer is yeah. Yeah, it's good intentions in and of themselves don't sanctify evil actions. We need to use God's methods for doing righteousness. So it is possible to sin with good intentions. Yeah. Anytime you disobey God, it's sin, right? Okay, what about trust? If somebody, you know, do they treat you horribly and then you forgive them, does that mean you also trust them? And I don't think you necessarily do. I think sometimes you can't immediately trust the person. You got to make sure they're trustworthy. So Joseph probably said, "I forgive you." But when he left the room, he probably didn't turn his back. Just got to keep his eye open on him. You know, I mean, that would be fine. Except, and I really want to say this, when you forgive, you might not immediately be able to trust, but you have to be willing to trust the person again. Because I've seen so many times, especially in marriage, where it says, "He's lied to me so many times, I don't trust him anymore. I'll forgive him, but I won't trust him." That's sin. To say, "I can't trust him right now," is okay. But I want to trust him again, and I'm going to give him a chance to win my trust, that's great. But if you say, when I ask him, "Is there anything he could do to win your trust back?" And they think, I can't think of anything. I won't trust him again. And that's, there's something in the heart that wants to do that, right? It's a form of revenge. I refuse to trust you again. I don't care if you've changed. I won't see it. And that's something we need to watch out for. So, okay, one more real quick, John. So, okay, what if you do the 10-to-1 ratio? You're thinking 10 thoughts about God's goodness for every one thought about the evil that's being perpetrated against you, and that one thought still overwhelms all 10 of those other thoughts. Yeah. I think you got to go to 20-to-1 then, because I really think if you spend enough time thinking about the good that God is doing, once your soul is persuaded something good is happening to you, you're not going to be upset. If ultimately, if the bad doctor is giving you something that's saving your life and you understand that, you're not going to get worked up. It's a constant battle, isn't it? I mean, you can, and I don't imagine that Joseph, it was no battle for him. I bet you, who knows? Maybe the reason he's in prison is so long as it took him, 8 years to learn this. Maybe he struggled with bitterness and then he looked to God and it's calmed down. And then he got reminded again and it's bitter. And then he got, and maybe it was a whole long process. I mean, these people aren't supermen. They're just like us. But if you keep focusing on God, then I'm not saying that the pain will just dissipate and go away. And I'm not saying it won't be hard. I'm just saying this is the path that God has given us. Right. It's not wrong. That's correct. It's not wrong to cry when you've been hurt. That's appropriate. But it becomes wrong if that dominates your thought processes more than thoughts about the goodness of God. Because if the thought about your hurt dominates your thinking more than thinking about God's nature and his goodness, what's going to be the overall direction of your life? It's going to be in the direction of away from joy. You want those thoughts about God to outnumber the thoughts about your pain. And that's just a lot of work. It's very difficult because the natural thing is just to fixate your thoughts on the pain and the wrong that was done to you. So, but no, it's not wrong to weep. It's not wrong to weep. Yeah, I would say Psalms is the place to go when you're working on seeing God, thinking about his nature. What is he like? You read a psalm and you just jot down everything in the psalm that states or implies something that's true about God, some attribute, something that's wonderful about him. Worship songs are great for that. You sing through a hymn or a worship song and you just jot down everything that implies or says about the goodness of God. I did that for years, and I compiled the results in that book, What's So Great About God, that devotional book, so that you could use that too. But as far as books of the Bible, yeah, I'd say Psalms is the most densely packed place with wonderful truths about the nature of God. So, great question. Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, you think about Paul and Silas singing hymns when they're in stocks and they're just beaten, and you tell people that, and it's like they write it off. They're like, that's far fetched. That's a Bible story. These people, they were angels. Paul and Silas are just regular human beings. They're just like, I guarantee, when they got whipped, they weren't saying, ooh, that felt good. I mean, they were saying, ow, ow, ah. And it hurt. But they put their attention back to God. And it could be that, that they did that so much that they actually felt like singing. Or it could be that they sang in order to help them feel that way. But one way or the other, they were turning their attention back to God. And it brought real, genuine, actual joy. It worked for them. It can work for us. They were men just like we are. Right. All right. So you're the perpetrator. You say, well, yeah, God's using me to deliver all this life-saving medicine to everybody. I'll keep it up. You're Judas. You don't want to be that person. Because remember, the solution to that is to remember what he said. God will judge the wicked and the righteous. He's going to judge you. He's going to punish you for that. The fact that God uses your wickedness to accomplish good doesn't absolve you in the slightest. So, okay, one more. Yeah. I actually mentioned it last night. I didn't think of it. I was trying to trim things down this morning because it's such a long sermon. But that's just another example of injustice. What happened in the shooting the other day? you try to be a good parent, you raise your kid, you try and keep them safe, you send them off to high school, and they get shot. That's just another example of the kinds of things that, you know, like all the things in Somalia and everything else, Uganda, the examples of horrific injustice. And how do we think about that? Do we just try to think, well, the student that did the shooting, you know, maybe he had mental illness, or maybe he had this, or maybe that, maybe this. Maybe... No, just think, God is going to make it right. He's going to make it right. And this should make me fear God. If people are walking around with guns and shooting people in high schools, that should make me fear God more than I'm afraid of guns.